Welcome to the History of Chemistry podcast. I'm Steve Cohen, your host, and this is episode 119, Tiny But Mighty, on the discovery of microplastics in the environment. Thanks to those who already support this podcast, support the continuation of this podcast at Patreon. The website is www.patreon.com/thehistoryofchemistry. With this episode, we officially reach the 21st century. The first six episodes of the podcast covered all of chemical history from prehistory to the year 1000. The next 111 episodes covered the second millennium of our current era, and now we begin the third millennium. As we get closer to the present, it gets harder for me to pick out the most germane chemical developments, but I will try my best. We've all encountered the effects of microplastics in a way. The millions upon millions of rubber tires on all vehicles slowly wear out. Heels and soles of shoes wear down. Have you ever thought of what happens only to the polymers that rub off your tires and shoes? At best, we sometimes see skid marks in the road, yet most of the time tires and shoes leave no obvious visible trace. Where does all that rubber go? If you interact with the news at all, you've probably heard about the environmental scourge of this episode, these tiny bits of plastic called microplastics. So, let's dig down a bit into what they are and how they were discovered. Polymers, or plastics as we've talked about, have huge advantages over many other materials. They are durable if designed right. They are lightweight. They can be made food grade, that is, non-toxic when edible liquids and solids are in contact with them. But then you discard them and their durability becomes a liability. We've already talked of recycling, but not all plastics are yet truly recyclable, and not all pieces of recyclable plastic get to the recycling plant. What happens to the non-recycled pieces? We hope they end up in a trash dump to remain there eternally, or until some future rubbish tip archaeologists want to learn about 20th and 21st century life. The unhappy truth is that, no, they don't always remain there. This was first uncovered way back in 1972 by Edward Carpenter and K.L. Smith of Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute in Massachusetts. Their paper, Plastics on the Sargasso Sea Surface, was published in the journal Science. I will read the abstract of their report. Quote, plastic particles in concentrations averaging 3,500 pieces and 290 grams per square kilometer are widespread in the western Sargasso Sea. Pieces are brittle, apparently due to the weathering of the plasticizers, and many are in a pellet shape, about 0.25 to 0.5 centimeters in diameter. The particles are surfaces for the attachment of diatoms and hydroids. Increasing production of plastics combined with the present waste disposal practices will undoubtedly lead to increases in the concentration of these particles. Plastics could be a source of some of the polychlorinated biphenyls recently observed in oceanic organisms. Unquote. The two sailed on the Institute's ship, the Atlantis II. With a net 1 meter wide, they sampled and weighed every plastic bit at the surface of the ocean in the Sargasso Sea, about 34 degrees north latitude, off the eastern coast of the United States. A similar study of the Pacific Ocean was published in Nature in 1974 by C.S. Wong, David Green, and Walter Cretney at the Department of the Environment in British Columbia, sailing from Tokyo to California, then northward to British Columbia. John Colton, Frederick Knapp, and Bruce Burns also published that year a study of the plastics collected in the northwestern Atlantic Ocean and found bits of polystyrene about 1 millimeter in diameter, bits of polystyrene about 1.5 millimeters in diameter, but with voids, bits of polyethylene about 3 or so millimeters in size, pieces of styrofoam, layers of plastic wrap, and a variety of other plastic pieces, the detritus of the age of plastics. By 1979, the northern Pacific Ocean was confirmed also to have tar and plastic bits through the work of D.G. Shaw and G.A. Mapes at the University of Alaska. In the mid-1980s, Kara Law and colleagues at Woods Hole began to sample similarly the plastics at the ocean surface, starting as college students in 1986 and continuing through 2008 off the Atlantic coast of the USA. Plastic debris, therefore, has been known for decades as a pollutant of the oceans and was predicted to collect in gyres, huge rotations of ocean waters that appear in the Atlantic, Pacific, and elsewhere. But what really caught the public's attention was the observation by a boat racer, Charles Moore, who, after competing in the Trans-Pacific Yacht Race, sailed with his crew in 1997 from Hawaii to California. Captain Moore passed through the North Pacific subtropical gyre and discovered many pieces of polymer surrounding his boat. To be fair, these gyres were already known as trash collections to the marine scientists, but Moore called up an oceanographer in Seattle, Washington, by the name of Curtis Ebbesmeyer, to alert him of his observation. Ebbesmeyer called the plastic-ridden area the, quote, Eastern Garbage Patch, unquote, and the name for gyres so polluted has stuck. You might think that so much plastic floating trash would be detectable by, say, satellites, but the density of rubbish isn't all that high. There are only around 4 pieces per cubic meter, at least on the macroscopic scale. Moore and colleagues eventually published some articles around 2001 and 2002 describing how plastic bits can mimic local plankton that marine filter feeders eat. They found that the mass of the plastic particles was 6 times that of plankton in the area they tested in the North Pacific Ocean, which obviously began causing concern for marine biologists. This all came to a head when Richard Thompson at the University of Plymouth in England published a short communication in the journal Science in May 2004 titled, Lost at Sea, Where is All the Plastic? Noting that so much worry was generated about large plastic pieces floating in the sea, but what about the tiny bits, those mentioned by Colton, Knapp, and Burns 3 decades earlier? Thompson and friends collected sediment from local shorelines around the Plymouth area. They filtered out the polymer pieces, generally around 20 micrometers in diameter, and identified via Fourier transform infrared spectroscopy 9 types of microscopic bits of polymers, from acrylics to polyester, from polypropylene to nylon. This indicated that the polymers come from mechanical breakdown of larger pieces, and perhaps from some cleansers that contain tiny abrasive particles. They also examined samples of plankton taken in Scotland since the 1960s and noted a gradual increase in such microplastics, as he called them, over time. The team even tested the ability of several marine species to eat such particles and found they all ingested micro bits of plastic. Their last sentence is still resonating today. Quote, more work is needed to establish whether there are any environmental consequences of this debris. Unquote. So this is the point in our chemical history, 2004, when microplastics were first positively identified singled out, and named. Then what is microplastic in detail? Microplastic is generally defined as any plastic piece smaller than 5 millimeters in diameter. Sizes of these particles range from a few micrometers on upwards. Some of the sources of these plastics are when larger pieces of plastic trash break apart by tossing around and hitting other items. Ultraviolet light, as we've heard, can embrittle some polymers. These polymers then are susceptible to mechanical failure and break apart more easily. Sitting out in the sun on the ocean day after day makes these polymers ever more brittle. Microplastics here can come from single-use packages and those ubiquitous water bottles. Textiles. Have you all seen the fuzz that you pull out of your laundry dryer after doing a load of laundry? The same thing happens when you wash clothing. Cloth will shed microscopic bits of fiber while sloshing around in the washing machine. Automobile, bicycle, truck, and bus tires rubbing against the road. Abrasive microbeads, about 1/4 millimeter in diameter, that cosmetics companies put into their cosmetic products, but also as an industrial abrasive. The granules of plastic used to make plastic items. By the way, these granules have a specific name in English, nurdles. N-U-R-D-L-E. Often a shipping container spills and the beads of plastic go into the ocean. Plastic feedstock for manufacturing also includes powders, and if those powders spill, they are also marine contamination. The worst spill of plastic into the ocean to date was in May 2021 off the shore of Sri Lanka. A cargo ship, the Express Pearl, caught fire and the ship exploded. The Express Pearl carried fertilizer, nitric acid, and caustic soda, like the Galveston explosion we mentioned from 1947. But those materials weren't the only cargo. Shipping containers containing 1,680 tons of nurdles were thrown overboard in the disaster, spilling everywhere. About 70 billion plastic particles were now in the sea. There was a brew of intact microplastics and burnt microplastics. By the summer, bits of plastic were found along 40% of the Sri Lankan coastline. Even worse, this disaster happened during fishing season. Nurdles were found in fish and sea turtles. The cargo manifest included 9,700 tons of epoxy resin, but so far we have no idea if this was liquid or solid, and what happened to that. Billions of nurdles seem outlandish, but how many of these bits does it take to make one single plastic item? Anywhere from 100 to 1,000. A plastic shopping bag might use 174 nurdles, while a 2-liter bottle for beverages might require 1,005. Thompson has noted that microplastics are found everywhere, in all beach sand, in fish guts, in polar ice caps. But how do they get into the ocean? Any litter dumped in a river can reach the ocean directly. Wind can pick up objects. Dust-sized particles are known to travel across the Atlantic Ocean from Africa to the Americas. Rain falling through wind, containing specks of microplastics, can catch these particles and fall into the ocean. Any ships that dump rubbish, fishing nets, or sewage directly into the ocean are also sources of microplastics. If there is a spill or ocean wreck of shipping containers, all the plastic can enter the sea. Runoff from streets flows into sewers that often directly pour into rivers, and any sewage or treated wastewater can be a source of microplastics. Scientists still have no way of reliably dating old microplastics, unlike, say, bones that can be carbon dated. I started off this episode remarking on how tires wear, generating microplastics. Let's talk a bit more of the problem. Tires may have up to 100 different compounds in them, such as rubber polymers, steel, fillers like carbon, antioxidants, curing agents, and chemicals to prevent ozone degradation. A recent estimate of how much microplastics they make is about 6 million tons per year, and they represent about 28% of marine microplastics. Tire particles are not spherical, but linear, perhaps 0.1 millimeters long. This amount of microplastics is only second to particles from breakdown of single-use plastics. The Tire Industry Project, a research team made up of 11 tire manufacturers comprising the majority of tires made, says that there is no significant risk from these microplastics. Technically, that may be true. Or maybe not. One antioxidant compound in tires, N13-dimethylbutyl N' phenylphenylenediamine, or 6-PPD for short, may be linked to large-scale fish deaths. But 6-PPD is crucial for long-lasting tires, and replacing it with a less toxic chemical that provides a proper vehicular safety margin is not easy. Not all plastic bits, micro or macro, remain near the ocean surface. Some will sink if their density is higher than seawater, or if marine organisms start to grow on them, raising their overall density. Processes that make plastic dive deeper include vertical mixing currents in the ocean, collection into larger clumps, or even if animals eat them and then defecate into the ocean. There is much research to be done concerning this question. Are microplastics harmful? Do they have physical effects? Do they act as poisons in some way? It's not entirely clear yet. One factor of concern is that plastic surfaces, being organic, are known to adsorb organic molecules and metals, which are long-term pollutants. By adsorbing on a polymer surface, these pollutants can become much more concentrated than in the surrounding seawater. An article in the journal Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society of London B, Biological Sciences, in 2009, found that polychlorinated biphenyls, a persistent pollutant, can move from plastic surfaces to animals. The problem in defining this is that different plastics with different pollutants sitting on their surfaces have different rates of transfer of these chemicals. The plastics themselves may have plasticizers that leach out of the microscopic polymers into the ocean water. All that said, so far, studies are not clear as to whether animals eating these plastic bits will suffer harm. In the laboratory, indications are that microplastics do cause harm, at least to a degree. Microplastics have been shown to affect embryonic and larval development, expression of genes, growth rates, reproduction, survival, and feeding. But not all studies show this, so it's not clear what's going on with microplastics. There is some evidence that shape and size of the particles affects their harm on organisms. That is, smaller particles do more harm, for they can enter individual cells of your body, and microfibers from tires and cloth, being linear instead of spherical, do more harm, perhaps by piercing cell membranes. For those of you who buy and drink bottled water, there seems to be nearly 100 times more microplastics in bottled water than American tap water. That is, research finds 325 particles in 1 liter of bottled water, compared with 5.5 bits in a liter of water from your tap. If possible, I'd stick with tap water overall. Unfortunately, the ecology and biochemistry of microplastics is still relatively unknown, so I cannot offer you definitive answers to this truly global, human-caused problem other than to pressure your local and national governments to reduce plastic use and make them do more to monitor and catch scofflaws who dump such plastics. The polymer industry will yell and scream, but what's more important here? This is a political question, not a scientific one. In our next episode, we explore a process called click chemistry, where chemists can snap together molecules almost like a construction set. Until then, brave the elements! Thank you for listening to the History of Chemistry podcast.